because it's Easter. That's the only reason I even figured it out. You know, this coming week, this Sunday is Orthodox Easter. I had no idea. I looked it up and I found it. April 29th is Laylat al-Qadr. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. That's a Muslim holiday. I don't know anything about there's no, let's not read in with malice to things that are just really no big deal. Okay, everybody relax, all right? I'm not trying to be disrespectful to anybody. Everybody's welcome to watch this show on any day, regardless of what holidays are going on. On the bonus show today, Netflix has lost viewers for the first time in 10 years. Their stock has absolutely crashed. I lost a bunch of money because I've owned Netflix stock for a really long time. I had forgotten about it. And yesterday, I guess I lost 40%. Okay, we will talk about what's going on with Netflix. Omarosa Manigo Newman has been awarded over $1 million in legal fees from the Trump campaign. Will she ever actually get it? And Senate Democratic candidate Tom McDermott smoked pot in a political ad to celebrate yesterday being 420. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Don't miss it.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT, the in sound from way out.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
FM, word to your mother.
In Sound from Way Out.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is a Democracy Now! Earth Day special. As Russia bombards a massive steel plant in Mariupol, still under Ukrainian control, we mark Earth Day by looking at how the war in Ukraine gives the United States a new chance to break free of dirty steel.
The war in Ukraine has highlighted how the U.S. steel industry is reliant on steel supplies from both Ukraine and Russia, and is also highlighting how this is an opportunity for the U.S. to begin green steel production and rebuilding U.S. steel industry.
Plus, we speak to an indigenous climate activist in Alaska about President Biden's plans to resume oil and gas drilling leases on public lands, breaking a campaign pledge.
We have scientists chaining themselves to buildings saying that we are headed towards a climate disaster. Biden needs to stop the oil and gas lease sales. No more drilling on public lands. We need a just transition today.
Then Powerlands, a new documentary made by a young Navajo filmmaker in Arizona about the displacement of indigenous people and environmental devastation across the globe.
It's not just our community that's affected this way. There's so many indigenous communities, there's so many people of color that have to face these realities every day.
We are not separate from our environment, and we have been damaged in this whole process of being colonized.
We show up to action with just ourselves, with our prayers, with our voices.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. New satellite images appear to show mass graves outside the besieged southern city of Mariupol in what Ukrainian officials say is evidence Russia's burying bodies to cover up war crimes. The release of the images came as the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said, quote, Russian armed forces have indiscriminately shelled and bombed populated areas, killing civilians and wrecking hospitals, schools, and other civilian infrastructure, actions that may amount to war crimes, unquote. Meanwhile, a top Russian general says his army is seeking full control over eastern and southern Ukraine. Russian news agencies quoted the commander as saying he's seeking to create a land corridor connecting Russian-controlled Crimea in the south with the eastern Donbass region. The strategy suggests Russia might be planning an assault on the Black Sea port city of Odessa. President Biden says the U.S. will send another $800 million in military equipment to Ukraine, including heavy artillery and tactical drones. The U.S. is also sending another $500 million in economic assistance to Ukraine. Biden's announcement came as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky continued to appeal to European countries for more weapons. He spoke by video Thursday to the Portuguese parliament.
We need weapons to defend ourselves from the brutal Russian invasion that has caused as much evil as the fascist invasion 80 years ago. Leopard tanks, armored vehicles, anti-warship harpoon missiles. This is what you have and how you can help us to defend the freedom and civilization of Europe.
An affiliate of the Islamic State has claimed responsibility for three bomb attacks across Afghanistan Thursday that targeted Shia Muslims and the minority Hazara community. In the largest attack, a bomb exploded inside a mosque in the city of Mazar-e Sharif, killing at least 12 people, injuring dozens. This is a survivor.
We urge the Islamic Emirate to pay more attention to the security of the people. How long will such incidents continue? Afghanistan's situation is so bad, we have no secure place to live.
Elsewhere, two children were injured in Kabul after a roadside bomb exploded near a boys' school in a Hazara neighborhood. A third bomb blast in northern Kunduz injured 11 people. French President Emmanuel Macron and far-right candidate Marine Le Pen are making their final appeals to voters ahead of Sunday's runoff presidential election. Several polls show Macron in the lead. This is Le Pen's third attempt at the presidency. She's a nationalist running on an anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim platform. Here in the United States, a new report by Human Rights First condemns the Biden administration for imprisoning tens of thousands of asylum seekers at Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that's ICE, jails, where they face prolonged detention periods, physical and psychological abuse, medical neglect, racism, a lack of legal and language resources, and other harms. The group says their imprisonment is wasteful, cruel, and a violation of U.S. and international law. This is Salma, an asylum seeker from Uganda, who was held at the Adelanto ICE Processing Center in California.
They transported me to Adelanto, which took almost 3 hours. Imagine being chained, all of your body being chained. You cannot even scratch yourself. You cannot even reach out for water for 3 straight hours. So when I got to Adelanto, I was told to hand over all my stuff, my passport, my everything. And these are things that I never got back. So I handed over my identifications. I handed over my phones. Immediately, they cut off my hair because it was braided. And then they gave me an injection that up to date, I don't understand what it meant.
In related news, documents obtained by a coalition of immigrant rights groups reveal ICE has contracted with a third-party data broker, LexisNexis, allowing it to receive real-time jail booking data from sheriff's offices in the state of Colorado. The move to track the whereabouts of immigrants curtails Colorado's sanctuary policies, which are meant to prevent state and local law enforcement from cooperating with ICE. Jacinta Gonzalez of Mi Gente's No Tech for ICE campaign said, quote, ICE agents once relied on the police to help them track us, arrest us, and deport us. Now tech companies, by selling our personal data, are helping them instead, unquote. The former Honduran president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, has been extradited to the United States. He was put on board a Drug Enforcement Administration plane Thursday in the capital, Tegucigalpa, and flown to New York, where he faces drug trafficking and weapons charges. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland announced the indictment at the Justice Department. He said Hernandez abused his position as president to operate Honduras as a narco state.
Hernandez is alleged to have received millions of dollars from multiple drug trafficking organizations, including from the former leader of the Sinaloa cartel, known as El Chapo. In return, drug traffickers in Honduras were allowed to operate with virtual impunity. We allege that Hernandez corrupted legitimate public institutions in the country, including parts of the National Police, military, and National Congress. And we allege that Hernandez worked closely with other public officials to protect cocaine shipments bound for the United States.
Hernandez was arrested in February, less than a month after his presidential term ended. He was a longtime U.S. ally who received backing during his entire 8-year term, despite mounting reports of serious human rights violations and accusations of corruption and involvement with drug smuggling. His brother, Juan Antonio Tony Hernandez, is currently serving a life prison sentence in the U.S. after being convicted in 2019 of smuggling cocaine. A federal judge has halted Kentucky's 15-week abortion ban, at least for now. U.S. District Judge Rebecca Grady Jennings, a Trump appointee, blocked the law from taking effect for the next 2 weeks after Kentucky's two remaining abortion providers said the law provisions
prevented them from continuing abortion care. Both clinics now plan to resume offering abortions. Kentucky Republicans passed the bill in March before overriding a veto by the Democratic Governor Andy Beshear last week. This comes as the Supreme Court is weighing Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban in a case that could overturn the landmark 1973 ruling in Roe v. Wade that legalized abortion nationwide. The Supreme Court has ruled the federal government can continue to deny benefits to seniors and people with disabilities living in Puerto Rico. In an 8-1 ruling Thursday, justices sided with the Biden administration, which says Puerto Ricans are not entitled to claim full Supplemental Security Income Benefits, or SSI, unless they move to the mainland. The lone dissenter was Justice Sonia Sotomayor, whose parents were born in Puerto Rico. She wrote in a dissenting opinion, quote, "There is no rational basis for Congress to treat needy citizens living anywhere in the United States so differently from others. To hold otherwise, as the court does, is irrational and antithetical to the very nature of the SSI program and the equal protection of citizens guaranteed by the Constitution," Justice Sotomayor said. Prison officials in Huntsville, Texas, have executed the state's oldest death row prisoner. On Thursday night, 78-year-old Carl Wayne Bunchen was strapped to a gurney and administered a single lethal dose of pentobarbital. Death penalty opponents have compared the drug's effect to drowning or being burned alive. In Tennessee, Republican Governor Bill Lee temporarily halted the execution of 72-year-old Oscar Franklin Smith Thursday evening, just hours before he was set to die. Governor Lee cited an unspecified oversight in the preparation of a 3-drug lethal injection cocktail meant to sedate and paralyze Smith while stopping his heart from beating. Meanwhile, South Carolina's Supreme Court has ordered a pause to next week's planned execution of Richard Bernard Moore. The court is weighing the constitutionality of South Carolina's new execution law, which requires condemned prisoners to choose between the electric chair and a firing squad. Newly published audio reveals top Republicans privately blasted Donald Trump in the days after the January 6th Capitol insurrection. The New York Times obtained a recording of House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy speaking January 10, 2020, with Wyoming Republican Congressmember Liz Cheney. In the call, Cheney asks McCarthy whether the House might pass an impeachment resolution.
Is there any chance, are you hearing, that he might resign? Is there any reason to think that might happen?
I've had a few discussions. My gut tells me no. I'm seriously thinking of having that conversation with him tonight. And the only discussion I would have with him is that I think this will pass, and it would be my recommendation we should do that.
Before the New York Times released that recording, McCarthy's office denied reports he'd privately called for Trump's resignation. In a statement, McCarthy called the reports totally false and wrong. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Mitch McConnell, who was Senate Majority Leader at the time, privately told colleagues after the Capitol insurrection that his party would soon break with Trump. He reportedly said, "If this isn't impeachable, I don't know what is." McConnell would go on to vote against convicting Trump during the Senate's second impeachment trial. And Republican state legislators in Tallahassee, Florida, have approved a gerrymandered congressional voting map drawn by Governor Ron DeSantis, which virtually guarantees Republicans 4 more seats in the House of Representatives. On Thursday, Florida's House voted 68-38 in favor of the map, sending it to Governor DeSantis for his signature. The vote was delayed after Black Florida lawmakers staged an impromptu sit-in protest against the congressional redistricting plan. Florida State Representative Diane Hard, a Democrat from Tampa, live-streamed video from the floor of the Florida House chamber as she joined Thursday's protest. She said DeSantis's map is meant to disenfranchise Black voters.
"We know that what the governor is doing with these maps is not fair. He is taking us from 4 representatives to 2. That's not fair. He should have allowed us, the legislature, to draw maps. His job is to either accept them or veto them. But he's not doing that. Instead, he's sending his own map. And he's saying, if you don't vote on my map the way I want my map to be, then guess what? You won't get a map.
Also on Thursday, Florida's House voted to rescind Walt Disney World's self-governing status after Governor DeSantis and his allies blasted Disney for opposing Florida's so-called Don't Say Gay law. The bill now heads to DeSantis's desk for his signature. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today is Earth Day. Intense fighting in Ukraine's Donbas region has led to urgent humanitarian concerns in the southeastern city of Mariupol. While Russia has claimed it seized control of the city, over 1,000 Ukrainian troops and civilians remain trapped inside the sprawling Azovstal iron and steelworks plant. Several attempts to create humanitarian evacuation corridors have failed. The capture of Mariupol would give Russia a land corridor to Crimea, which it seized from Ukraine in 2014. The steel mill is Mariupol's last line of defense, and among its defenders are members of the Azov Battalion. That includes far-right soldiers. It's faced the heaviest shelling and is cut off from electricity, water, and food. In a video message, Ukrainian Marine Commander Serhiy Volina pleaded for help.
We are only defending one object, the Azovstal plant, where, in addition to military personnel, there are also civilians who have fallen victim to this war. We appeal and plead to all world leaders to help us. We ask them to use the procedure of extraction and take us to the territory of a third-party state.
This comes as Ukrainian officials say as many as 9,000 people may be buried in a mass grave in a village outside Mariupol. On Thursday, President Biden met with the Ukrainian prime minister and was asked at a news conference about Putin's claim Russian forces are now in control of the port city.
One thing for sure we know about Mariupol. He should allow humanitarian corridors to let people on that steel mill and other places are buried under rubble to get out, to get out. That's what any head of state would do in such a circumstance.
For more, we begin today's Earth Day special with the authors of a new piece in The Intercept headlined, Russia-Ukraine War is Another Reason to Break Free of Dirty Steel, but U.S. companies still chase profits over green future, unquote. The steel industry accounts for 8% of carbon dioxide emissions and uses about 15% of the world's coal. Today, we're joined by Justin Mikulka, research fellow at New Consensus, and Zach Exley, who's the think tank's founder and executive director. They work on detailed plans, such as the Green New Deal, for governments to transition to clean energy. Zach was a leader of the 2016 Bernie Sanders presidential campaign and is co-founder of Justice Democrats. Justin's a longtime energy reporter. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! We've been reporting on the horror of what's been taking place in Mariupol. It's not clear how many people have died there. It's believed somewhere over 10,000. Some are putting the numbers at over 20,000. But today on Earth Day, we're going to look at the site of where 1,000 or 2,000, several thousand people, both Ukrainian soldiers and civilians, are holed up, the steel plant. But we're going to look at the actual... Well, what is produced there? And Justin Mikulka, we're going to begin with you. Talk about the significance of this particular plant, one of the largest in Europe, and what it means overall in the context of Earth Day, in the context of sustainability. We're just trying to hear Justin. Well, Justin, can you hear me? Justin?
Can you hear me now?
Okay, why don't we go... Justin, can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay, great.
I'm sorry about that, Amy. Yeah, I believe that this steel plant is a traditional one of the this is the type of facility that has made most of the steel that has built the world. What we wrote about in our article also is that the U.S. Has been relying on Ukraine and Russia for imports of the building block for the steel process, which is called pig iron. And we'd already been looking at the pig iron issue because in our efforts to clean up the steel industry, the global steel industry, which we need to do, as you mentioned, it creates 8% of our emissions. Pig iron, the production of pig iron, which is actually the process of taking iron ore and making into a raw metal that is then the feedstock for making all finished steel products, that's where the emissions, that's where the majority of emissions are. And that's because coal is used in that process. The majority of it is done with coal. And so this plant and the Ukraine industry is one of the dirtiest, highest emissions steel producing industries in the country or in the world. And so when we think about reducing emissions, the U.S. industry actually is a leader in new types of production of steel that are lower in emissions. But those steel, that process, it's called the electric arc furnace, requires what the pig iron. And we've been importing that dirty pig iron, the high emission stuff, from Russia and Ukraine. So what we've been doing, while we can claim in the U.S. that yes, we are actually producing fewer emissions than other steel producers, we're basically outsourcing our emissions. And so what we need to do in a global effort, but in the U.S. as well, is clean up the production of pig iron. And we've been told, steel has been one of the industries that's been referred to as hard to abate. But that's no longer true because there now is technology using green hydrogen, which is hydrogen that's made using renewable energy made from water. You can use that to replace the coal in the process and create something called sponge iron, which is essentially the equivalent of pig iron. So we have the technology to do this, to clean up the steel industry. But what we've been doing here in the U.S. is relying on steel mills like the ones in Ukraine to produce our pig iron for us that we've been importing. So it's the industry in itself needs to address emissions, but the U.S. industry has been sidestepping it and is not leading in any way on producing green steel with green hydrogen.
The CEO of a leading U.S. steel company, Cleveland-Cliffs, has said his company's coal-fueled blast furnaces are, quote, here to stay. Lorenzo Gonsalves spoke to CNBC last month. This is what he said.
My competition needs pig iron, but they don't produce pig iron. They need to import pig iron. And a lot of this pig iron comes from, guess what? From Russia and from Ukraine. Ukraine, unfortunately, is being beaten down, and that's a very sad situation. Russia is the perpetrator, should not be allowed to sell a thing in the United States. So we are in a good shape because we're self-sufficient, made in USA.
Justin Mikulka, can you talk about the significance of what he's saying? You write about this company in the article.
Yeah, so what he's making an argument that CEOs like to make, that they're doing it the right way and they want to point the finger elsewhere. But the fact is that company is operating some of the remaining coal-fired blast furnaces, which are required to make pig iron. So his argument is that pig iron, which is also some of it is made with natural gas as well, which is a whole different issue with methane emissions. But his argument is that some of his competitors in the U.S. have been buying Ukraine and Russian pig iron, which is true. But he's also at the same time saying, I'm not in any way going to stop using coal to produce pig iron here in the U.S. And that's why what we talk about in the article, other countries around the world, Germany, India, Canada, the governments are taking an active role in working with companies like Cleveland-Cliffs in the U.S., for an example, and directly funding the replacement of these blast furnaces and directly funding projects to produce the renewable energy and green hydrogen to make green steel, to eliminate the majority of emissions from steel production. So what we're seeing in the U.S. is again, it's there, the industry itself is making exceptional profits right now. What's happening because of this shortage of pig iron that's going on in the world right now, steel prices have gone way up, pig iron prices have gone way up, And like with the oil and gas industry and a lot of other industries right now with inflation, that means corporate profits have gone up, and that's getting passed on to the consumers. So there isn't any real incentive for the U.S. steel industry to change their business model. And that's why we argue that we need government policies, we need industrial policies that address this, because we have to clean up the U.S. steel industry. And what we really need to be doing is, instead of importing dirty steel, we need to be exporting green steel to the world, because we're going to need a lot of steel to build out the wind turbines, the solar farms for the energy transition. For that steel is a wonderful material. It's infinitely recyclable. We do a great job of recycling it in the U.S., but there's nothing that's going to replace it anytime soon. So we need to clean up the process of making steel.
Zach Exley, you're one of the architects of the Green New Deal. You report that steel is essential for the development of renewable energy systems like wind turbines, which are largely made from steel. Can you talk about this and how this example fits into the broader clean energy transition outlined in the GND and the Green New Deal?
Thank you so much for having us. We already knew that the world economy was destroying the planet, but now we're seeing also how fragile it is. And especially the U.S. economy is incredibly fragile because both parties in this country have followed policies out of this commitment to a very esoteric ideological kind of purism that they believed that we should actually shut down our ability to make things. They decided that leaders in both parties decided that, you know, Americans should just be doing nice, clean jobs at computers and, you know, not dirty jobs like working in steel mills. So they actually followed policies to shut down our ability to make our means of making a living. And the idea was that people in countries like China and Ukraine would make all the stuff that we needed. So now we're seeing that when things aren't going exactly the way, you know, everybody expected at the end of history, that it suddenly becomes very difficult for us to just get the basic products that we need. So the silver lining in this development, in this realization, is that, you know, people in both parties now leaders in both parties, some of them, are starting to realize that we actually need to rebuild our ability to make stuff and make our own living. And because of what we need to do in the world economy and in the U.S. economy to stop global warming and stop greenhouse gas emissions, we've got a real opportunity here to start building clean industries that can make the stuff that we need without changing the composition of the atmosphere and without polluting the oceans and everything else that's going on. So what we're recommending, a core piece of the Green New Deal, and what we're working on at New Consensus right now, is trying to talk about how do we rebuild institutions in this country that will allow us as a nation to build the industries that we need, the clean industries that we need. One of those institutions is financing, right? Most industrialized countries in the world that have been successful at creating prosperity and giving a good means of making a living to most of their people, they have some system of public financing, so that when it doesn't make economic sense for corporations to, you know, spend hundreds of billions of dollars to build a new industry that isn't going to generate massive profits anytime soon, there needs to be a public funding system to just make that happen. So most countries have that. Most industrialized, prosperous countries have that. The United States does not have it. Our strange pattern of economic development is that usually around a big war, whether it was the Civil War or World War II, we sort of create these institutions temporarily and build a whole bunch of industries and then shut it all down right after the crisis. So we're entering into a new period of crisis here with global pandemics, with global warming, and now with wars, hopefully not another world war, but already something a little bit like it. And so we what we're arguing is that we need some permanent institutions to allow us to build the industries that we need, the clean industries that we need, and to really also build them at the scale where the United States can contribute to a global transition. And we need to do that as fast as possible.
Zach, this comes as the Biden administration announced a new policy this week that requires projects funded by the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure package to source their construction material with U.S. steel. Will this be harder because of the pandemic and war-related supply chain issues? You say it would be cheaper if made in the U.S. with green energy. You write, in Germany, the government's directly funding the replacement of pig iron producing coal-fired blast furnaces with green hydrogen technology to produce sponge iron. What can Biden do?
It's difficult because unfortunately the ideas around like how would we go about building a new clean steel industry are just starting to get into some of the circles of the Democratic policy circles and the Republican policy circles. So I think the thing that Biden should really do right now is get on TV and lead, you know, as a president and say, look, we've made horrible mistakes over the past several decades. My party and the other party both did this. We shut down America's means of making our own living and making things that we need like steel. And so we've got to rebuild it. And we know that we've got to rebuild a steel industry that is clean, that is not spewing greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and heating up the planet. And here's my plan to do that. And there are simple mechanisms that Biden could use. For example, we already have a big bank in the government. It's in the Treasury. It's called the Federal Financing Bank. It would just take a small tweak to change that into a bank that could not only fund the agencies of the federal government, but that could also fund something like investment in a new steel industry. We've got proposals for that plan on our website at newconsensus.com. That's the kind of thing that Biden could lead on and really get Americans into the mindset of we've got to learn how to do stuff again here. And we've got an opportunity and a responsibility to do stuff in a way that is not destroying the planet and that gives the United States more security and gives the whole world more security.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Zach Exley, Executive Director of New Consensus, think tank working on detailed plans such as the Green New Deal for governments to transition to clean energy to address the climate crisis and renew their economy. And also Justin Mikulka, a research fellow at New Consensus, has reported on the energy industry for years. Zach also was one of the leaders of the 2016 Bernie Sanders presidential campaign. Oh, I do have to ask you something, Zach. I know we're ending, but we haven't lost you yet. Is Bernie Sanders going to run for president yet? Do you have anything we don't?
I have no idea, but of course, I hope so. You know, I hope we get a bunch of people running and providing some alternatives and leading on some of these messages that we just talked about. I think we need that.
Well, thanks again. Again, Zach Exley and Justin Mikulka. We will link to your article at democracynow.org. It's called Russia-Ukraine War is Another Reason to Break Free of Dirty Steel, but U.S. companies still chase profits over green future. Next up, Powerlands, a new documentary made by a young Navajo filmmaker in Arizona about the displacement of indigenous people and environmental devastation across the globe. Stay with us. Ala sine li ko tat nisa away ahi anga away ahi anga away ahi ahi the keg od has li na so se yen si ko na so se away ahi anga away ahi anga away ahi Manahasan yukaya, Jonah e posan Seed of Life by the Navajo singer and activist Radmila Cody. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our Earth Day special by looking at how Indigenous people are protecting the Earth as we follow the journey of Ivy Camille Menibeed-So, an award-winning queer Navajo filmmaker whose new film shows how corporations like Peabody, the world's largest private coal company, have devastated her homeland. She also connects with Indigenous communities in Colombia, in the Philippines, in Mexico, and at Standing Rock in North Dakota, facing the same types of struggles. This is the introduction to Powerlands.
My name is Ivy Camille Menibeed-So, and this is Dineta, also known as the Navajo Nation. My family can trace our history to 85 generations with this land. I began working on this film to document our community's struggle against resource colonization. Along the way, I found that we are not alone. This is a story of Indigenous people protecting and rebuilding.
Before we speak with Ivy Camille, this is another clip from Powerlands that features some of the Navajo elders and young land and water defenders in the film.
They want the land from me. They want to take away my livelihood. The sheep and horses. These are the ways they try to intimidate us. If a horse roams close to the house, they say we have to pay a fee.
For a long time, people were terrorized with livestock impoundments, having their livestock being forcibly taken away. And of course, that's traumatic for people, you know?
They've done things where they've brought big trailers out here and have literally, you know, forced people into their homes, you know, with, like, you know, guns. Before someone to point guns at elders and tell them to back up and for them to just come in here and take what's theirs, you know, it's just not right. And, you know, it really hurts that people do that, you know?
For more, we're joined by Ivy Camille Menibeed-So, whose new film Powerlands just won the award for Best Feature at the 2022 American Documentary and Animation Film Festival. She's joining us from Flagstaff, Arizona, where there's a massive wildfire burning very close to where she lives. Ivy Camille, welcome to Democracy Now! Congratulations on your film. But before we talk about the film, can you talk about this fire that's exploded right now in size and what and if it threatens you and your community?
Yeah, so the fire started, I believe Tuesday we got the alert. It was really rapid. Within like 15 minutes, there were like three or four evacuation notices that came out just like literally in rapid fire. You'd like call somebody to check and then there'd be another street that was being evacuated because of the massive winds that were happening. The firefighters are doing incredible to try to keep, you know, as many homes safe as possible. But there's definitely been loss of homes and loss of property and loss of just a lot of loss. You know, you hear stories about families who had a 1-year-old and all they could grab on their way out the door was the child, you know, and so they've lost everything. But this community really is incredible and helping everybody get together and stand together in it. On Tuesday, you know, I was out trying to help clear brush from places, especially with alders who had a hard time getting underneath their porches. But yeah, it's pretty close. It's moved a little bit further at the moment, but for about 2 days, the sky was just full of smoke.
I mean, your film is all about sustainability. And in fact, this fire that's exploded to something like 20,000 acres, fanned by high winds and fueled by the dry grass that you're dealing with. The Arizona and the other western states are suffering an unprecedented mega drought brought on by the climate emergency.
Yeah, and the desertification that's happened around here definitely can be tied directly into Peabody Coal and BHP. They were, you know, pulling thousands and thousands of gallons of water out every day. And in doing so, made it so that the water resources down below are very depleted, which means that all the plant life is dying quickly. So there's a lot of brush for it to move. And then the winds, as I've heard from recent people, is just, they're going to keep staying this way. We're going to have high winds in this area due to climate change.
Well, I want to go back to another clip of your award-winning film, Powerlands, on the resistance of Diné, of Navajo youth.
Younger generations are returning to Diné Ta, building unity and resistance.
This lake, it's called Morgan Lake. It was built to cool down the power plant, which is one of the dirtiest coal-fired power plants in the country. They've extracted uranium. They extract oil and gas by fracking. They extract coal. All around, there's this resource colonization, this resource extraction.
An average person in Phoenix uses about 200 gallons per day as far as domestic use. And a person in Big Mountain, they use about 12 gallons a day. You know, corporations and dirty politicians, you know, they're all about money. You know, they want money, 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 money. I'd like for these guys to have them try to eat money, you know, and see what happens to them. Have them drink oil or drink water that's contaminated with oil, you know. I don't think they're going to last.
So, Ivy Camille, you deal with coal here. Talk more about the largest private coal company in the world that people, particularly Native peoples in Arizona, are dealing with, Peabody. And the whole issue of how it has affected your livelihoods, your lives.
Yeah, well, I was born into the resistance out of Black Mesa. My the matriarch of my family, Meso, passed away in 2021 due to COVID. And, you know, we saw that throughout the res. So I've grown up having it impacted my entire life. I grew up knowing about HPL versus NPL and what that meant and what it meant to, you know, carry my name and carry that forward into the world and how you need to hold yourself as a Indigenous woman. And as well as, you know, I was taught being raised that we are shepherds, that we do not own the earth. We belong to the earth. And so in that sense, we have to, you know, make it better and continue doing so. And one of the ways to do that currently is to, you know, help stop climate change and to help stop this massive extraction of these, you know, very precious resources.
You know, before we move on to the global picture, I wanted to ask you about an issue you refer to in the film. You don't focus on it, but it's certainly one I'm sure you know. Earlier this week, Marketplace published an article titled, "A Ban on Russian Uranium Could Impact Tribal Communities in the Southwest." The article reports some U.S. lawmakers unhappy with American nuclear power plants' reliance on imported Russian uranium are pushing for a ban on those purchases. About 16% of the uranium that fuels the electricity-generating facilities comes from Russia. An additional 30% is imported from Russia's partner nations, Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. If the ban comes to pass, the U.S. uranium industry would have an opportunity to ramp up domestic mining. But many indigenous communities are still reeling from the impact of the last uranium boom. On Navajo lands, for instance, there are more than 500 abandoned mines, according to the Environmental Protection Agency. So that was a report from Marketplace. But the residue of the impact that uranium mining has had on indigenous communities, particularly the Navajo, the Diné, particularly the Hopi in Arizona.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up knowing where the open pits were, where they're just filled in with concrete. That's the only protection against them. The miners, the old miners, would actually be given blocks that weren't usable blocks, but would still have radiation and uranium in them, and they would build their houses with it. So it would infect, you know, their wives, their children, and generations on. So we're still dealing with those. And all it is to stop those buildings is just a fence. And I've grown up seeing it. You know, we get taught knowing not to drink certain water sources because they are contaminated with uranium. And a lot of people don't have any options. You look at places like Cameron, where it has some of the highest radiation in the entire world. And it's like every day people are living there and doing their things. And it's, you know, right off of 89, which right now is affected by the fire. But there are tourists and people going through every single day. So it's not just affecting, you know, the Diné Nation. Like, it's affecting everybody who's passing through it. Any truck drivers, tourists, whatever, you're unwittingly and unknowingly being contaminated by these open pits and leftover radiation that we are still attempting to clean up and deal with.
And of course, these uranium tailings, highly carcinogenic, the issue of cancer in the Navajo indigenous communities in the Southwest, Ivy Camille.
Yeah, we're seeing a huge spike within, you know, cancer rates. There's issues with pregnancy. There's issues. There's so much that you can see. It's really just, without going into statistics, just looking around, you're seeing people get cancer who, you know, it doesn't normally pop up in our family bloodlines. You're seeing people losing certain, like, mental faculties quickly, like, way faster than they should be because of this radiation. You can see the effects in all over the res, and then even in outlying areas, because they're also being contaminated. It's not just, like, contained in a city.
Well, we want to continue on the theme of your film, Powerlands, after this break. We're talking to Ivy Camille Menibidso, an award-winning queer Navajo filmmaker. Her film, Powerlands, just won the award for Best Feature at the 2022 American Documentary and Animation Film Festival. Stay with us.
There's gotta be some hope. There's gotta be some hope. There's gotta be some way for you to send your dogs away and to leave the land alone. It's gotta be a crime. Somewhere in your heart you'll find, we're fighting for our right to keep the future bright and protect the ones we love.
In the River by Ray Zaragoza, as we continue our Earth Day special here on Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. We're speaking with Ivy Camille Menibidso, award-winning queer Navajo filmmaker whose new film, Powerlands, just won a major award, follows her journey examining corporations like BHP that have devastated her home and connecting with indigenous communities in Colombia, the Philippines, Mexico, and Standing Rock facing the same struggles. We're going to go to another clip from Powerlands now. We go to the peninsula of La Guajira in the northern tip of Colombia, close to the border of Venezuela. This is the site of the Cerrejón large open pit coal mine owned by the UK, Swiss, Australian conglomerate of BHP Glencore. This is Ms. Eneida, who's been repeatedly displaced by Glencore in the film Powerlands.
El agua no la quitaban.
They took away our water and electricity. They took everything away because we had to leave one way or another, taking things away from us to force us out.
A clip from Powerlands. Tell us who Eneida is, as well as what is happening in Colombia now, Ivy Camille.
Yeah, so really, Eneida and all of the women in the film are these matriarchs of these communities. That's in traditional Diné culture, we're a matriarchal society. So they're the ones leading the resistance. They're the ones cooking the food. They're the ones holding these communities. They're the ones holding the space for it. So that's one of my favorite parts of the film, is seeing all these, like, really strong, incredible indigenous women. And then in Colombia, I should have been more prepared. There's still resistance going on. There's a lot to be told about it, and really everywhere. I think, truthfully, the most important thing about the film to know is that it's for Indigenous people, by Indigenous people, or an Indigenous person, and it's about showing this global scale, because it's Colombia, Oaxaca, Standing Rock, Black Mesa, and the Philippines. All of these places seem so vast and far apart, but truthfully, it's everywhere. There were so many places that we reached out to that, you know, weren't ready to speak with us at the time, weren't ready to go there. And we are seeing them coming out with their stories now. But truthfully, so many of these communities, like in Colombia, have no Wi-Fi. They don't have access to being able to reach out, you know, to other people. All of the energy is being sourced from these communities, but they get none of it for themselves. And, you know, so having a film like this and showing it and having a way to be able to tell all of these communities, like, you're not alone. You know, we're all here with you, and here are more forms of resistance. Here are more people continuing to fight, and, like, please tell your own stories.
I mean, it's amazing what you show in Colombia. You say the coal from that mine is shipped to Europe, about a third sent to the U.S. and elsewhere in the Americas. The mine's taken over about 270 square miles of land, larger than the city of Chicago. And can you talk about all the forms of resistance, from the food to the language, the art, the culture?
Well, and I think in all of these indigenous communities, the simple tasks are the ones that, you know, preserve our culture and our heritage, because there is a massive genocide going on. They are wanting to eradicate our voices. They want to eradicate our ways of life. They want to eradicate our culture. And so, continuously going out and listening to an elder speak, learning how to cook the traditional foods, learning how to make the traditional clothes, learning how to make the traditional tools are especially helpful going forward in this climate change, because we have obviously lived in extreme climates, and so we know how to farm in desert climates without using up all the water. There's lots of different resources that can go forward, you know, just in the indigenous communities and indigenous worlds. And I think that those simple things, you know, as a kid going out and listening to my grandma, I'm so thankful for the moments that I got to have with her, because every time an elder dies, that entire lifeline of stories and everything dies with them. And so the more people who go out and hear those stories and document them, you know, the more we will have for this preservation.
So we're going to continue on your journey, Ivy Camille. Powerlands features the community of Bangmal in the Philippines, in Mindanao, where indigenous earth defenders successfully forced out Glencore's copper mine, a gold copper mine, in Tapakan in 2015. This is a clip.
The central part of our area here is where they plan to put a wastewater dam. I told our people here to listen to their hearts before allowing the mines in. We know what their intentions are, to seize our resources.
I want to continue on the journey and then have you put these two together. Going from the Philippines to Mexico, to specifically to Oaxaca, in Powerlands, this is one of the earth defenders, Ivy Camille, that you speak to.
Visto, pues, en otros pueblos.
We've seen in other towns that no, it's not true that wind projects bring benefits. And people realized that, and they decided to fight back with a resounding no. Why? Because we live off the ocean.
Zapotec and other indigenous communities in the region have for years been resisting wind farm mega projects that are displacing them from their ancestral lands. And that's particularly interesting as you fight for sustainability. We're talking about wind farms. Work your way backwards. Start here in Oaxaca, and then we'll talk about the Philippines.
Yeah, well, one, that clip that you just played, being on set with that man was incredible. I don't speak Spanish, and so I was just feeling what he was feeling and then getting translated afterwards. But the emotion, the care, the love that is, you know, in all of these is evident even without words from these communities. It's incredible. And yet in Oaxaca, you're seeing a massive displacement that's going on without proper care and treatment of these wind farms. You're also seeing pollution entering water sources, you know, that's cutting off their food resources. So what's really incredible about Oaxaca is they are doing they are making their own community wind farm that's going to be held to higher standards and also will provide power to that community. Because, again, these communities aren't being provided the power that they are giving to the rest of the world. Oaxaca was incredible to see these people, so much like color and light and everything coming out of it. I think that was one of my favorite places to film, because without language, like, it was just incredible.
And your time in Mindanao, your time in the Philippines, the struggle that is going on there.
Yeah, so I was not able to go to the Philippines. My producer, who you've actually had on for, Jordan Flaherty, was there for the Philippines. But really, it was incredible. Again, the same struggle, the same resistance. You're seeing these people, like, show these foods and these ancestral healing things that I know we have here on the reservation, and you're seeing it in every single community we're going to. There's things to treat chronic cough. There's things to treat, you know, like sore hands, bad backs, even stomach problems that we don't have currently going around. But when you listen to these indigenous communities, you're finding out the root basic of a lot of the pharmaceuticals that we have also in those where it originally comes from. And it's brilliant to see.
So, Ivy Camille, many beads so. As you take us on this journey in this powerful film called Powerlands, talk about why you called it Powerlands. You've been doing this since you were 19. What started you on this path?
Yeah. So, yeah, we've been doing it for about 8 years. What really started was Jordan had been filming in Colombia. I was filming in Black Mesa, and we were looking at the parallels between them, and they're both affected by BHP. And, you know, if you took away the language, I would not tell the difference between Colombia and Black Mesa, besides maybe the monkeys. It is incredible. You know, growing up in Black Mesa, we would constantly have to be careful of, like, what day the mine was going or what things, because you would have the coal coming down and affecting clothing or affecting certain livestock. And it was the same stuff that we were hearing in Colombia. And that was really the beginning of this story, was seeing the parallels. And then from there, Jordan went to the Philippines. While we were in Oaxaca, that's when I found out about Standing Rock. And so we went up to Standing Rock immediately afterwards. And Kim, who was one of the people featured in the film, was one of the first people to arrive at Standing Rock and set up there. And it's been cool to also see how that transition between communities and the collaboration that's been going. Even recently, Bettina was in LA working with my composer, who's also been on the show, Daniel French, and was able to speak with him right while as he was, you know, making the soundtrack for the film. And it was really cool because that influenced it as well.
Finally, Ivy Camille, you say as you cover the resistance around the world, your film is part of that resistance. We have 15 seconds.
Yes, this film is for Indigenous people. You are not alone. We are here. And if anyone else learns something from it, great.
Ivy Camille Menibitso, award-winning queer Navajo filmmaker who directed the new film Powerlands, just won the award for Best Feature at the 2022 American Documentary and Animation Film Festival. For more of our coverage on the climate catastrophe and the indigenous struggle to protect the Earth, well, every day is Earth Day here at Democracy Now! Go to democracynow.org. Oh, we have an immediate job opening for a news writer producer. Go to democracynow.org for more information and apply immediately. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Everybody ready?
Ready for Whiskey Before Breakfast? I am. I'm Mando Richard. Thanks so much for tuning in to episode 2216 of this very eclectic folk show I call Whiskey Before Breakfast. We'll start off like we always do on the liquored up side of the family. We'll close down as we always do on the gospel side of the family. And in between, I've got a mixture of new stuff and old stuff that, if they're not your favorites already, I sure hope they will be soon. Let's start off the liquored up set with Barbara Jo Cameron doing a record that's been a hit for several different people. I think Patti Loveless does a great version too. This is Barbara Jo Cameron's version of Cheap Whiskey. Thanks for tuning in to Whiskey Before Breakfast.
Staring back on his loss yesterday, long before he encountered the bottle and the demons that drove her away. In his hand he is holding her photograph, her image all tear-stained. He's embracing reality and he curses the day he was born. And the darkness still echoes her warning. Can't have two loves in your life. Now the things that still haunt him to the day that he for a drink. And the darkness smell of cheap whiskey and the sound of goodbye. Now the things that will haunt him till the day that he dies is the smell of cheap whiskey and the sound of goodbye.
Another night in the same old